All right. I realize we're getting a 45-minute early jump on this, so did it? I feel the same way. How many were blessed this morning and during church? Man, wasn't that great? I tell you what, I was really blessed too. Well, Dr. Chadwick, we're very fortunate to have one more talk here. He's going to talk to us this afternoon, I believe, about sedimentology and the chronology of that and what that means for the creationist in terms of time. And some of those evidences and some of those ideas. I feel very fortunate to be able to sit here and listen to Dr. Chadwick way back when I was a college student with him. I still remember. He was the teacher everybody knew. You really had to be prepared for his classes. And it was a good thing because you learned more. But I can still remember the last class I took from Dr. Chadwick was called Cellular and Molecular Biology. And I walked in. I thought I prepared okay. But walked into his class, and he had two piles, two stacks of paper with him. And I said, boy, this is going to be interesting. And he said, I've got two tests for you today, and you can choose. It was a choose-your-own-adventure kind of test. And you could choose between the two piles. And exhibit pile number A was an essay test written by Dr. Art Chadwick. And so all of us were very interested to know what the second pile was going to contain. The second pile was I think it was a graduate level cellular molecular biology exam, standardized exam for graduate students, not for college students. And the entire class simultaneously got up and walked to the advanced testing pile and grabbed that one. We were all so scared of what might be in the other pile that we thought our chances were better at the graduate level than at Dr. Chadwick's level. So I still don't know how that turned out. I kind of have that blocked from my memory, but it has been a real privilege. Dr. Chadwick, more than he knows, has been a mentor to me. Again, what a great privilege it is to have you here, Dr. Chadwick, and I think we probably just need to make this a yearly thing. So welcome. Thank you for talking to us about sediments this afternoon.
And I know some of you are probably suffering from postprandial depression. I don't need that. So, what are we going to talk about this afternoon? Let's talk about something that we haven't covered yet. We've discussed. Last night we talked about dinosaurs and whether dinosaurs are legitimate things and they really exist on the earth. And we decided that they did exist and they were real. And in fact, that they were something amazing that God created and will probably be in the earth made new. I didn't say all that last night, but I'm saying it now. And I look forward to that. I look forward to meeting some of these players. Where did they live on the earth when man was here? Probably somewhere else. I don't know that that was an everyday occurrence to see a dinosaur, for a giant man that we think were on the earth before the flood. We also have talked about molecular biology in the context of creation and what it tells us about the probability of life having come into existence by itself, and us being here today as a result of mindless, directionless processes, as Richard Dawkins likes to say. And we saw that it's virtually not a realistic probability to think that a living system could develop that has the complexity, any living system, but that specifically that has the complexity of the modern cell that we understand from our understandings of modern molecular biology. So that being excluded from our consideration, why are we still here looking? Well, there are other issues that we need to talk about, and we're going to talk about one of those now. Looking for time in all the wrong places. Why science really matters. First, let's start out by looking at what science cannot do. What science cannot do. That means that when we are through, we're going to be thinking, let's see, science can give us these kinds of answers, but it can't give us these kinds of answers. So what is it that science cannot answer for us? And so to do that, let's take a look at the situation in science today. We have a lot of things as creationists that we don't have explanations for. Among them are radiometric dating. I'm sorry to tell you that I'm not going to explain away radiometric dating today. I'm not going to do that. I'll talk about it, but I'm not going to give you an answer that will allay your fears and concerns forever. Is that okay? There also are other dating methods that seem to give times that extend beyond a few thousand years. And those also have been used by evolutionists to try to discomfit creationists. And so that's something else that we need to leave in this basket of things that challenge the concept of a fiat creation. So there's some stuff in the basket that challenges fiat creation. Also, there's an orderly fossil record. We don't understand why it is that you see trilobites down here, different trilobites here, different trilobites here, and it tends to be worldwide. We don't understand that. It doesn't mean there's not a good explanation. It just means that we weren't there to see what the earth was like, and we can't imagine what kinds of processes must have gone on during the flood. The hominid record, the record of fossil man. Do we have all the answers there? I don't think so. I think we have some good answers. I think I could give you a whole talk on that. We could talk about what I think the best explanation for what we see is the record of fossil man. But for right now, I'm leaving it on the table as a problem for us. It's a challenge for creationists. I think it's also a challenge for evolutionists, but it's a challenge for creationists. So there are some things that you can't go home today and say, well, he satisfied what I said, what I wondered about here. However, there also are a bunch of stuff that are problems for evolutionists and challenges the concept of evolution that creationists don't have a problem with. Number one on this list is the origin of life. We haven't talked about the origin of life. Origin of life means you have a earth that has water on it. We could also discuss the origin of water. But you have an earth with water on it, and now it has life on it. How do you go from an earth with water but not life to an earth with life? How does that happen? Evolutionists will do a lot of backpedaling when you ask this question of them, because evolutionists don't have a clue what the answer to that question is. They've been studying since the 1930s, trying to figure out how to make life happen by accident. And all they've gotten is deeper in the hole that they've dug for themselves, because there isn't any light at the bottom. And the more we know about life and its complexity, and you saw some of that this morning, to get a living cell, you have to have some of those basic things that we showed in the video. You have to have some fundamental things that are very complex. And I pointed out briefly in the question section that there is a number of maximum probability, which is the maximum number of events that can happen in 16 billion years that supposedly the universe has been here. The Big Bang happened 16 billion years or 13 billion years or something like that ago. And so you know how much time there was. We know how many particles are in the known universe. We don't really know what the boundaries of the universe are, but within the known universe, we have about 10 to the 80th power particles, those are protons. So we know how many particles there are. We know how fast interactions occur between those particles. If we count out all the possible interactions between all the protons in 16 billion years, We get a maximum probability number of about 10 to the 50th power. That means there are only 10 to the 50th power events that can happen with this many particles in this many years. Is that clear? So anything that has a probability of happening greater than 10 to the 50th is not going to happen within the bounds of statistical reasoning. So that means if you tell me that the probability of getting a given protein is 10 to the, let's say, 10,000th power, that protein's not going to happen by accident in 16 billion years. Now, we don't really have 16 billion years. If we believe the best dates for the age of the Earth, it's 3.4 billion years or something like that, 4.3, whatever it is, that's a whole lot less than 16 billion years. So that makes it even less likely that anything could happen in that time. So origin of life is a good thing to bring up when somebody has challenged your faith on the basis of origins. Just ask them to give you a scenario for the origin of life. And listen to the backspin, because it will happen. The fossil record has some features that are very difficult for evolutionists to explain. And we talked about that this morning during the Sabbath school period, how the sudden appearance of all life forms in the Cambrian is striking. They're all there. All the major groups of organisms are represented in the lower Cambrian without any predecessors. Well, that's not what evolution's supposed to show, and that's what we see in the fossil record, and everybody agrees on that. They call it the Cambrian explosion, and they try to figure out how it could have happened, but nobody really has an idea. Then there's the general absence of intermediate forms, and I spun that out a little bit this morning about the work of Donald Prothrow, and how he has shown that 160 lineages of mammals show no change from their first appearance in the fossil record until they disappear from it. And that is typical of what the fossil record shows. So that's a problem for evolutionists. Then there are things in the fossil record, in the rocks and so on, that show extraordinary events took place. And there is a general lack of evidence for time in the fossil record, and that's going to be the subject of our talk today. And then there's molecular biology, as I've already mentioned. So these are things on the side of creation. So when we put them in the balance, we see, oh, there's a bunch of stuff that favors creation. Oh, there's a bunch of stuff that favors evolution. If we stick them on the balance, guess what? It doesn't look like this. It doesn't look like this. It looks like this. So what does that tell us? If you have the same thing on both sides of an equation, you don't have to be a star mathematician to know they cancel out. And that means that if you try to use science to determine where you came from, it's not going to work out too well. And in fact, those who know the science understand that they are getting their information about where they came from somewhere else. Now, where is that somewhere else that they're getting their information? Anybody have an idea? The Bible. Okay, that's one source, yes. Feeling. It might have to do with the consequences of accepting one belief or the other. For example, if I choose to believe in creation, then I have a problem. Hello, Brenda. This is Brenda Bulwark. She is the owner of the ranch that we get our dinosaurs off. She lives down here in Parker. She came up to be with us today. Thank you, Brenda. She's shy. Huh? No. The ranch is in Wyoming, but she lives in Parker. So... So I went through on that last slide yet. So what about the decision between believing that there is a God and there isn't a God? Is that going to affect which one you decide to choose? And that God has some demands on your life and might object to your doing certain things you like to do or not doing certain things you should do? And so that's a convenience, isn't it? So maybe we'll just call that convenience. There are a lot of things that affect what you believe, what your parents taught you when you were little, whether you had an upbringing in a spiritual environment or not. These all will go into this pot that is you that determines what you're going to believe about origins. Nobody can come to me and say, well, I believe in creation or I believe in evolution because of the evidence. I'm sorry. God didn't set it up that way, and it's not going to be. So you have to believe it. You have to admit that you believe in origins, what you believe, because of something besides the science. Is that hard to take? No, it's not hard to take. That's the way God intended it. If the science were compelling one way or the other, who would be making decisions opposite the science? If the science was compelling, there would be no choice. And what is this whole great controversy about if it's not about choice? Whether you will choose this day who you will serve or not. That's what it's about. And if God takes away that choice, we are the losers. And he could end the whole thing right now. But God gives us a choice, and that choice involves more than one possibility. If there's only one possibility, it's not choice. So the fact that we don't have all the answers to all the questions is something we should celebrate, because it leaves us dependent on God and faith. Okay, that being the case, why do we do science? Because science can do some neat things. It gives us a chance to look at the world around us. I make my living digging up dinosaurs. How many people would like to do that? You can test ideas about the natural world to see if they work and find out whether some idea is good or bad. And if you are a good scientist and you use the methods correctly, your science may attract other people to your belief. If you're a good scientist, you can actually lead other people to Christ. And that's a good thing. And besides, science is fun. In spite of what you might have thought when you were a kid, science is fun. Do you remember your chemistry set? Remember baking soda and vinegar? How much fun you have with that? That's science. Understanding how all that works. So science is fun. And that's reason enough to want to do science, if you can figure out how to make it pay your bills. All right, so now let's deal with time. That's why we're here. The most common interpretation of the fossil record radiometric dates gives us life on the Earth for billions of years, and at least hundreds of millions of years. The most common accepted interpretation of radiometric dates leaves us, if we accept the conclusions from radiometric dating, leaves us with the conclusion that life has been on the Earth for hundreds of millions of years. Although progress has been made in trying to understand why we get those long ages, efforts to resolve the discrepancy so far have not been successful. And contrary to what some people may tell you, we don't have good answers for all these questions. And that's going to stay that way, I think, until Christ comes. We are not going to have all the answers to all the questions. But certain features of the geologic record enable us to say something about time from the rocks themselves. And that's what we're going to talk about today. What can the rocks tell us about how much time there's been? So you ready? All right. If rocks were deposited over millions of years, what if the sediments that made the rocks, if they were deposited slowly over millions of years, what kinds of features might we see in the rocks that would tell us that? If sedimentary processes happened within a year's time, if most of the rock record was accumulated during a one-year period, the one-year period that Noah and his family spent inside that box, what kinds of things might be different about the rocks? More than 10 years ago, Dr. Leonard Brand and I set out on a journey, a venture, to try to examine the rocks in the Colorado Plateau to see what they could tell us about time. We use the Colorado Plateau for reasons that should be fairly obvious to you here. If you've ever been out in South Utah, and that's where we did a lot of our work, you know that there are a lot of rocks showing out there. It's easy to see the rocks because there's not much water. We could go to Africa and look at rocks there. That would be interesting to do. But in Africa, there's a lot of water most places. And the Sahara is covered with sand. So that doesn't give us very good way to view the rocks. But the southwest of the United States is barren of vegetation. And that's why it's so beautiful. That's why we go there for vacation. I don't know why in the summertime. But that's when we go there. Actually, it's a high plateau, so it's fairly cool. And that's where we work. All right, so we're going to look at these five issues today as we have time. And we're going to find out what they each one tell us about geologic time and whether we can trust radiometric dating or not to determine how old the Earth is or life on the Earth. The sediment accumulation rate. The sediments appear to have accumulated faster than geologists tell us from radiometric dates. So if you date a layer of rock here and a layer of rock here, and you look at the sediments in between, those sediments are ascribed to the time interval between those two layers of rock that are dated. So that's one way you can determine how old they are. There are other ways, and we're going to look at some of those. This is a picture of the Moenkopi Formation in the Southwest Desert somewhere, and it's ascribed to 10 million years by radiometric dates. Radiometric dates and fossil dates I'm using interchangeably because the fossils are generally indexed by radiometric dates. So if you find fossils in a rock, those fossils are given a time period based on radiometric dates somewhere else. So let's say 10 million years for the accumulation of that sediment. The alternative explanation, which is it happened during the flood of Noah, is that maybe a few days or hours, I don't know. So that's a big change. How can we determine the answer? Well, we can measure the rates of deposition in modern sedimentary environments. We can put a stick out in the lake or out in the ocean where sediments are accumulating, and we can look at it every year and find out how much new sediment occurs every day, every year. Does that make sense? And when we do that, we get rates that are of the order of centimeter per year, somewhere around centimeter per year, more or less. That's the rate of accumulation of sediments in a depositional environment. Or we could refer to some external information about past time and apply that to the record. So we could look at radiometric dates above that layer and below the layer, and we could ascribe that much time to those layers. Or we could go to another external source, which would be the Bible, and we can look and see how much time the Bible allows for the accumulation of those sediments, and we're stuck with days, weeks, months, year, if we're going to put it in the flood. So those are two different ways we can look at the rocks from an external source. Or the third approach we could take is to look at the sediments themselves and decide how fast did these particles have to be moving in order to get there and deposit out. And that's a third approach we could take to try to determine how long these sediments represent. Is that clear? So let's take a look. Here is where modern sedimentary environments give us a record of about a centimeter per year, somewhere in there. If we go by radiometric dating, we get rates that are three orders of magnitude too slow. So 1,000th of the rate that we get from the modern environment. That's a problem. It's a problem so profound that several geologists have devoted their careers to studying it. And their conclusion is, well, sediments have to be deposited fast. Then they're all eroded away, and then they're redeposited and eroded away many times during that time period. And finally, they get trapped, and some gets left behind. Okay, so that's the conclusion of geologists who recognize this problem and try to approach it from within their paradigm. They say this represents the redeposition of sediments many, many times. Is that clear? You understand what they're saying? Okay, but look where it is on the scale. Way over there on the left-hand side, 10 to the minus 3 centimeters per year. That's 1 centimeter every 1,000 years. That's the rates that radiometric dating give us. However, we don't think that it was deposited at the same rate it is today, do we? It had to be deposited a lot faster. And in fact, this is the rate based on the biblical chronology. It's about, let's say, 10,000 centimeters per year or more, 10 to the sixth, a million centimeters per year, something like that. That's going to be what we see with the biblical model. Well, that's way faster than the modern rate, which we understand that's not a problem, but it's also that much faster than the radiometric rate. So can we bring any experimental data to play on this? Yes, we can. A study that was done in Russia, in which the scientists forgot about the radiometric dates and just looked at the sediments themselves and said, what kind of restrictions do we have on rates of deposition based on the kinds of sediment and the processes by which they were deposited? And they came up with rates that were 20,000 to a million times faster than the radiometric rates. Wow, that's pretty close. That's ballpark to where we want to be. So the actual sedimentary data is in agreement with the biblical timescale, not with the radiometric timescale, for the rates of deposition in the fossil record. All right? So those that have tried to explain this, I think I already told you that. They want it to happen many times over and over again. Where's the data for that? All right, number two, sediments do not appear in equilibrium with their environments. Now, equilibrium with the environment means the sediments are deposited, and then whatever is going on in the environment affects. No cheating here. When you deposit a layer out in the ocean, on the bottom of the ocean, what's going to happen to that layer? You have animals down there, and they're living in that bottom, aren't they? So what are they going to do? They're going to grind it all up. They're going to bioturbate it. The organisms on the bottom of the ocean bioturbate the sediments, mix them all up, so the sedimentary structures that are indicating a depositional event are all gone. Do you understand that? If you have a bunch of worms living in the bottom down there, in short order, those worms are going to be moving that sediment around, and the original sedimentary structures will be gone. We're going to show you some of that here in the Colorado Plateau. But first, I have to give you a quick lesson in geology, sedimentology, bredimentology here, where one layer of bread represents a layer of sediment that are deposited. So you have one layer, in comes another, 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 and now you have a stack of sedimentary layers, just like in Grand Canyon. And how can we know if there was time between these individual layers or not? Well, let's watch what time does. Go back to one layer again. Let's not put the next layer on top. Let's let it sit there for a while. So what happens? Pretty soon it's moldy. Maybe a rat comes along and eats holes in it. But in any case, when you put the next layer on it, you're going to know that there was some time went by between those two layers. Likewise, you're going to know that time did not go by between the next layer up. How long is the next layer going to be free of mold? Since there's mold on the layer underneath, it's not going to be free of mold very long. So we know that then if these layers all don't show any more mold, we know they were deposited quickly. Are you getting it? Are you sedimentologists now? Or bredimentologists anyway? Okay, another thing that can happen when you have a layer like this is it can be eroded. So let's erode it and take it away and now bring in another layer on top. And wow, can you tell that there was some time there? at least enough time to erode that layer? Yeah, you can tell that. So you guys are now equipped to make decisions about the fossil record as to whether a lot of time went by or not. Now let's take a look at what we actually see in the field. And what do you see? All the sedimentary structure is still there. Well, you're just showing us one particular place where all the sedimentary structure is there. What about the whole rock record? What is the case there? I guess you're just showing us the best case, right? Well, let's take a look. Here you can see some of those features, how fine they are. All preserved. All preserved. These are homogenized sediments. They're very rare, by the way. When you do find them, you have to make a pilgrimage there to see them. They're so rare. Typical rates given for sediment accumulation, remember, are of the order of 1 centimeter per 1,000 years. Remember that? Based on radiometric dating, it takes about 1,000 years to accumulate 1 centimeter of sediment. How fast do marine invertebrates burrow? How fast do these worms burrow? Some experiments have been done in which a sedimentary layer was deposited out in a basin, and then a year later, people went back and they looked at it. It was totally homogenized. Okay, in 1 year, a layer 4 centimeters thick that was deposited in a sedimentary basin off the coast of Netherlands was completely homogenized. No internal structures present. But we can do a lot faster than that. In fact, experimental studies have shown that within adequate number of bioturbators, we can get complete homogenization within an hour. So you put in a layer 4 centimeters thick in an experimental tank with 10,000 bioturbators, which is not unusual. There are up to 60,000 of these preepulid worms in a square meter. So that's not out of the expected to have 10,000 of them there. Within 1 hour, it's totally homogenized. All the internal structure, all the sedimentary features are gone. So then if you had another event an hour later, what would happen? It would be all bioturbated because they're already there, and they would be burrowing up through that next layer. So you'd get it all homogenized. That's what we expect to see in the fossil record. At these rates, all sediments deposited on a radiometrically determined time scale, that is, 1 centimeter per 1,000 years, should be, are expected to be, and must be completely homogenized, all the internal structures gone, in which case, if it were true, all sedimentologists would be out looking for another field of work. Because what do sedimentologists study? They study the internal structures of the rocks. And if they were all homogenized, they'd have nothing to study. So the very fact that sedimentologists are in business and have something to do is an indication that there hasn't been a lot of time. Richard Bromley, who wrote the textbook on bioturbation, he says 100% bioturbation of the substrate, that is the surface of the ground, is natural end product of the activity of the bioturbators, the worms, the crayfish, the whatever it is that's burrowing, gophers above ground and so on. That's the natural end product of the activity of the endobenthos, the burrowers. Failure to reach 100%, in other words, if we find a place in the fossil record where there are still some sedimentary structures, any of you ever been to, let's say, Zion National Park? Checkerboard Mesa, you see those beautiful crossbeds? Those crossbeds are telling you that sand accumulated fast. Because if it had accumulated at the rate of 1 centimeter per 1,000 years, it should all be wiped out. There shouldn't be any beautiful crossbedding in Zion. Failure to reach 100%, or the failure of that state to be preserved in the rock record, are conditions that require explanation. So if you're a geologist, you better have an explanation for why there are sedimentary structures in rocks. You hear that? Wrong with radiometric dating. So let's go back here and take a look at some places just so you know this was not an extraordinary site. These diagrams that I'm going to show you are all the same, so it'll be easy to figure it out. On the, let's see if I've broken that down. Yeah, on the left-hand side, you can see the geologic column. You can't really read it. These diagrams are too complex. But this is everything from Cambrian up to recent. on the left-hand side, and then you can see it expanded up to the area we're studying here. It's in the lower part down in the Paleozoic, and we're looking at the rocks there. And here's the diagram that matters on the left-hand side. Do you see the black line? That black line tells us how much bioturbation there's been. And number one, as you can see over here on the right at the bottom, number one means no bioturbation. So if column one is full, that means there hasn't been any disturbing of the rocks. That means something's wrong if radiometric dating is right. So anything in column one is the indication that something's wrong with radiometric dating. Okay, column two says there's been some bioturbation, a significant amount. Number three says there's been a lot of bioturbation. There's been a lot of activity of the endobenthos. And number four is complete homogenization. So number four is the condition we better find everywhere in the rock record. Everything should be in column four if there is geologic time is correctly represented by radiometric date. You see that? So I'm going to show you now the results of many years' work here. And we're going through some diagrams. We're starting down at the bottom of the column and working our way up. Since you can't really read these diagrams, I'll have to explain a little bit. On the left-hand side of the diagram, the first line is representing where we can't see into the rock. Maybe it's covered by plants, or it's just not a kind of rock that we can test the hypothesis in. Then the next part, the middle part where the black is, that's where there's been some bioturbation. I'm sorry, I was wrong. The first column over there is not occupied anywhere in this diagram. Everything is in column one, which is the second column, or column two, which is the third column. And so this indicates that the 160 meters that we measured, centimeter by centimeter, looking at the rocks, centimeter by centimeter, for any indications of bioturbation, that all of that at the upper part and all of that at the bottom part has no bioturbation in it. The middle part, there is an area that does have some bioturbation. So we found some bioturbation. That means that some time had to elapse between the deposition and the covering up of these sediments. Okay, let's go to the next diagram. And this is the middle part. This is, looks like the Moenkopi. This is in the Permian. And notice it's all in column one. No bioturbation. That's, if I can read it, looks like so many, 600 meters maybe, something like that. 600 meters, that's 1,800 feet of sediment with no bioturbation. That's a problem for geologists. Here's another one. This is from the Upper Permian. This is the Kaibab Formation, all in column one, no bioturbation. This is up into the Moenkopi Formation here, and you can see it's all in column one, no bioturbation. Here is up into the middle part of the Jurassic, the Chinle Formation. And each of these diagrams is typically hundreds of meters of thickness of sediment that we've gone over centimeter by centimeter looking for any evidence of bioturbation. There is none. Okay, here's the Sundance Formation, no bioturbation. Here's the Upper Jurassic, not sure what this is, no bioturbation. And then here in the Mesa Verde Formation, we found some bioturbation. Do you see where it is? Where the breaks are in the right-hand column, notice there's some over clear to the left-hand side, to the right-hand side. Those are completely bioturbated. They're 100% bioturbated. So there had to be at least enough time between the deposit of that layer for all of the internal sedimentary structures to be obliterated by bioturbation, which takes how long? Up to an hour to a year, somewhere in that range. We'll ascribe to it. But most of it showed no bioturbation. Yeah.
So, are you saying that radiometric dating doesn't take into account this?
Okay, yeah, let's clarify this. What I'm saying is that standard geologic chronology based on radiometric dates says that this layer of rock took 15 million years to deposit. And that means that if it's 100 meters thick, that means it was deposited at the rate of a centimeter per 1,000 years, something like that. So you finally got it all accumulated. It had plenty of time for complete homogenization. And I'm saying there's no homogenization. And that equates, according to Richard Bromley, that equates to no time. No time. Here's another deposit. This includes some stuff up by Price, Utah. If you've ever been through that road cut, it's pretty spectacular. Very little bioturbation. There's a couple of instances there where we find complete bioturbation. Mostly no bioturbation. This is the upper part of the Cretaceous, no bioturbation. Hundreds of meters of sediment, no bioturbation. This is unjointed, but there's no bioturbation there. It's just that we couldn't see into the rock in a lot of places. And up here at the Green River Formation, no bioturbation. So, to make a long story not any longer, the conclusion we draw from this study is that when we look at the rocks and we look for evidence of time, based on our criteria, that there should be enough time between these layers for complete homogenization, what do we see? The vast majority of tens of thousands of meters of sediment, that's 100,000 feet, 30,000, 40,000 feet of sediment that we've looked at, in all that sediment, we don't find almost no evidence for time. So sedimentologically, we don't see the millions of years that radiometric dating tells us is there. So my conclusion from that is that something's wrong with radiometric dating. It's not telling us time. All right? There's a general lack of erosion in the fossil record. Not only do we have deposition, but erosion is the other process that's going on. And look at this. There is no place in the world where you can go today where there is not either erosion or deposition. One of those two processes is going on. If deposition is going on, you're building up sediments. If erosion is going on, you're tearing them down. There is no place in the world where nothing happens. Everywhere is in one of those regimes or the other. And sometimes it changes. And we go from depositing to erosion, like when a dam breaks. But generally, it's stable. There's a general lack of erosion in the geologic record. So we talked about deposition. Now we're talking about erosion. Let's take a look at this. This is a paper we gave at Geological Society of America a couple of years back. Does the Shinrin-Mohmood contact represent a 10-million-year depositional hiatus on the Colorado Plateau? So we're asking the question that we obviously are trying to answer, which is no. The answer, obvious answer is no. Here's where we looked. You think geology isn't a lot of fun? This is southern Utah. There's the map of Utah up there. This is south and southwestern Utah. And each of those outcrops is a place where we went and photographed and studied. And, of course, you can't go to that many places and photograph and study in a lifetime. So what we did is we used a helicopter. And we flew along the outcrops, and we took pictures as we went. And all these pictures were geo-coordinated, so we could just map them onto the map, so you can see where all those places are now. And so I have all that data in my computer, and I'm actively working on this, preparing a paper right now on this subject. Here's the issue. The Shinrin Formation, which is the bottom of the Chinle up at the top, is supposed to be 220 million years old, 216 million years old. The Moenkopi, which is down here at the bottom, is supposed to be 247 million years old. So there's about 20 to 30 million years missing in there. You get that? That's based on fossil evidence. So the geologists tell us that there's a hiatus there, a gap of 10 to 30 million years between those two layers. Okay. 10 to 30 million years, let's take 20 million years as a mean figure just so we can talk about it. And that's what it looks like. that's pretty flat. In fact, it's remarkably flat. It's so flat that it's almost impossible to imagine any time having gone by between the deposition of the red stuff below and the white stuff above. Now we're going to take a look down here in the lower right corner. You see the arrow, that's a distance of 20 kilometers. And there are the layers. And just take a look at that white layer. Notice that thin white layer, which is about that much sediment. It goes all the way across the diagram. So these layers are long-ranging. That means that we can tell, by looking at that, we can tell whether the top surface has been eroded or not. And when we look at it over a wide area, we can say with confidence that there's been very little erosion between those two layers. Here is one place where there is some erosion. You can see a little dip there. But that little dip looks like the sediments are pushed down underneath it, doesn't it? It doesn't look like it was eroded out. It almost looks like somebody sat on it. And if we look at the contact between the two, here you see the upper white layer above and the red layer below. And pushed into the red layer are load casts, which are indications that the red layer was still soft at the end of the 10 to 15 million years. It was still unconsolidated, still not rock. It was mud, soft enough mud so the overlying material squished down into it and made load casts. Here's some more load casts. Here is another place where that layer occurs, and that red arrow is indicating a bed of unique material, white material, that's right along the contact. There you can see it. And here it is on the underside of the layer. And here it is squished up between two load casts. You see the load cast below? This is looking sideways at the bottom of the layer. And you can see those two load casts. So we can say with definite certainty that this was not consolidated when the next layer came in. That has its own problems we don't have time to go into today. But it looks like the Moenkopi didn't sit there for 10 to 15 million years without erosion or deposition or lithification. Nothing happened during that time. How can you have nothing happen for 10 to 15 million years? There are many other gaps in the fossil record that are bigger than this. In fact, there's one in Grand Canyon that looks perfectly flat, but it represents 140 million years of missing time. 140 million years, when nothing happened in the fossil record. That, to me, suggests that something's wrong with our calculations of based on radiometric dates. All right, let's look at one more feature here, erosion. The continents are still here. Modern erosion rates tell us that California is moving toward New York at the rate of 0.75 to 1.5 feet per year. Do you know that? You could buy land in Nevada and have beachfront property in a few hundred thousand years. That's based on current rates of erosion. We are moving, California is moving toward Florida. And in just a few million years, says less than 15 million years, California beaches would be in Florida at current rates of erosion. In fact, calculations by one of the leading geomorphologists in the world suggest that in 10 million years, all of North America will be eroded down to sea level at current rates of erosion. All of North America will be leveled to sea level at current rates of erosion in 10 million years. That's the amount of time that's represented by that gap. Enough time to erode all of North America to base level at current rates of erosion. Something's wrong with radiometric dating. In fact, North America should have been eroded down to base level between 20 and 60 times in the amount of time it's taken to deposit the layers that we see in Grand Canyon. 20 to 60 times it should have eroded all of North America flat. And that means that any place on North America where we find 6 months from the past that are still there, that's telling us it hasn't been hundreds of millions of years. Because the layers are still there. The erosion rate in 10 million years, it's all gone. Anything older than 10 million years shouldn't be there. And yet we have stuff that's 500, 600 million years still on the continents. What was happening during all that time? Well, it wasn't eroding. Here's an entirely different line of thought. Biomolecules. You've all heard the story of T-Rex and how they found soft tissue in T-Rex. This is a picture of some of that tissue. I just put it up there in order to show you what they found. You see that little bridge between those two red pieces? That's plastic material that looks like vascular tissue. Here's another picture that was published that shows some of these fossil vessels that still have red blood cell-like things in them after 65 million years. 65 million years and it still has collagen-like material in it. Well, it's been changed, okay? It doesn't look just the way it did when it was alive. But it's still there. How long can biomolecules persist? Well, that's pretty much the same kind of physics as radiometric dating that determines how long biomolecules last. It's called thermodynamics. And we can calculate just how long a molecule lasts because we can put it in a vessel and heat it up and determine at a higher temperature what it does and then extrapolate that down to room temperature. And we can know for certainty that molecules such as proteins only last a few thousand years at most. And here we have some molecules that are supposed to be 65 million years old, and they look pretty good. They look pretty good. In fact, when I do cross-sections of bone, dinosaur bone, I told you last night, when you make a thin section of dinosaur bone and you look inside, you can see the actual cells and the nuclei in the cells. Now, it's not a nice round nucleus. It's kind of a black blob in there. But it's still there. There's still something in the nucleus that's different than the surrounding cell inside this tissue that is still bone after 65 million years. Well, you know, there's a bit of a problem because who can tell me whether a bone would last as a fossil for 65 million years? And you say, well, they're there, aren't they? Yes, but are they 65 million years old? That's the question. So we assume that they can last long periods of time because we think they're long periods of time. But if we don't think they're long periods of time, there's no way to discern whether a bone could actually last for 65 million years. And things are changing all the time. There are molecules moving into the bones. There are molecules moving out of the bones. How long would it be before all those molecules moved out of the bone and went somewhere else? We don't know the answer to that. But we know that molecules can't last that long. And so how do geologists respond when they hear this? Wow, that's really interesting. You know, it's like, let's go look for some more. It's not a realization that this is impossible because their paradigm doesn't allow that. Their paradigm is that there is no God, or if there is a God, he doesn't interfere in our science. Our science is sacrosanct. We can't let him in. It's called naturalism. Naturalism is a philosophy that precludes the existence of a God or the activity of God in science. It's very ego-boosting to think that God can't mess with your experiment, isn't it? You know, you think you're the top guy and you understand everything that's going on and God isn't around. But whether that's true or not is a different story. So, in conclusion, sedimentology indicates by rates of deposition, we see that the rate of deposition is many times faster today than it was in the past and would be much faster if a geologic catastrophe had occurred. By the absence of bioturbation, we recognize that the time that's ascribed to sediments by radiometric dates doesn't comport with the situation that we see in the fossil record, because we do not see evidence of bioturbation in these sediments, and we ought to see. Number three, the absence of evidence for time within the strata themselves in what are called hiatuses or unconformities, and other features where radiometric dates tell us one thing, in the fossil record, the actual observations tell us something else. And even the survival of biomolecules tells us something's wrong with radiometric dates. Now, do I know what it is? Not at this point, I don't. I can't tell you, well, radiometric dates make this assumption and that assumption's wrong. I can't tell you that because I don't know. But I can tell you that something's wrong with the dates we get by radiometric dating. Something is seriously wrong and it needs to be addressed. And so we're writing papers right now and trying to get them published in respectable journals so that we can get the community to recognize this. And we're having some success, but we still have a long ways to go. If you want to pray for something, pray for our efforts to get the word out. Because this data is solid data. It's unassailable. But nobody knows it yet. Until we publish it, nobody will know it. They all know that they're sedimentologists because they see the layers in the strata. They all know that. But they don't think, well, let's see, there shouldn't be any layers here because this represents a long period of time. They shouldn't be seeing these layers in there. They should be looking for work at McDonald's or something else. But in fact, they are working as sedimentologists precisely because there is no time in the rock record. Thank you. Questions? Yes. Why do we see different layers of rock, different colors? It's probably because of different source areas. One of the problems that creationists have to struggle with is you're trying to do this all in one year. Where do you get all these sediments from? We have mile thick, 10 miles of sediments, thicknesses. How do we get those sediments? Where do we get them from? There's 25,000 feet of Pennsylvania sediment in just outside Salt Lake City in one deposit. Where did that sediment come from? Where does all this sediment come from? If you're a conventional geologist, you got 500 million years to figure out the answer to it. But if you're thinking it happened in 1 year, you better have a source for those sediments. And they had to come from somewhere. And we don't really know where it was. But our studies on paleoccurrence, which I don't have time to go into today, indicate that it's coming from off of North America. These sediments are all coming on to North America from somewhere off of North America. And same thing in South America and other countries. But that's a problem that needs to be addressed, is where do we get all these sediments and how do we get these layers there in the first place? And so that's an easier problem for conventional geologists than it is for us, just because they can say, oh, it was the erosion of these rocks or the wearing down of this granite or something like that. Other questions? Yes. Oh, okay. Why are some rocks soft and some rocks hard? Is that your question? We're digging up our dinosaurs in material that's so soft that if you took a hose out there and sprayed it, it would wash away, some of it. Other people working in Utah are digging in solid rock, trying to get a dinosaur bone out, and they have a real struggle to get anything out. That's because of different levels of cementation of the rock. So what happens is after the rock is buried, presumably it gets buried deeper in the earth, and the overlying sediments pressing down on it cause the mineral grains to move together and press against one another. And when they do that, they transfer molecules from one grain to another. And also the fluids that flow through the rocks leave behind iron or calcite or silica or something that cements the grains together. So there are a lot of different ways that rocks get cemented. All of them have to do with some kind of pressure and often with the movement of fluids through the rocks. Can it happen fast? Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're asking? Yeah. I'll tell you one experiment I know about how fast it can happen. There is a friend of mine who runs a laboratory for geologists up in Canada. And he had a device one time that was for pressure testing rocks to see what the porosity is. If you're an oil geologist, you care a lot about how much porosity a rock has. So there are ways of measuring that. You put the rock in a chamber, and then you push water through it under high pressure. I mean, we're talking 50,000 pounds pressure. And he was doing this, trying to test this rock for cementation, and he noticed the gauge was going down like this. And when he opened it back up, he found out the rock had accumulated material in between the grains in that short a time. So it had actually cemented while he was watching it. So it can be very fast. I'm sure it's not all fast, but we know, for example, of petrified trees that have occurred just in a very short time where the material has infiltrated the wood and then deposited silica inside the wood. So it doesn't take millions of years. It can happen relatively fast. Yes. Yeah. This is a question about radiometric dating and how reliable it is. There are a lot of different radiometric dating methods. Radiocarbon is one. Radiocarbon is the only one that we have a good handle on, and it's the only one that dates fossils themselves, and it's the only one that only, or it's the one, it only lasts for a few thousand years. It's only good for at most 20,000 years or something like that, or 40,000 years. All the old dates that we're looking at in the geologic record, the part we were talking about today, are by radioisotopes other than carbon, like rubidium, strontium, or potassium, argon, or lead, uranium, or lead, or something like that. There are a number of other isotopes that are used for dating. And those all give millions of years, and they all date, they have to date rocks that were at one time molten and then cooled so that you can get a starting point. And there are some assumptions, yes. Those assumptions seem to be reasonable, but it's not beyond human interpretation. Everything involves interpretation. No rock jumps out and says, I'm like that time clock up there says, I'm 5 million years old. What it does is it gives a certain ratio of a certain isotope, and that ratio is extrapolated back to zero time to find out how long ago it was. Well, the isotope they'd probably use, potassium argon, it would give a zero age on a recent flow, for example. But that's zero plus or minus 100,000 years, because the half-life of potassium argon is 2.5 billion years or something like that. So you can't get 1.25. So you can't get down to little tiny dates like that very accurately. But the other problem is sometimes that lava gets in the water, gets in the ocean, and it cools fast. And when it cools fast, it traps the argon inside the rock. And so you can get spurious dates that are millions or billions of years old, even in modern rocks sometimes. Well, that offers some clues about what's going on, but it doesn't solve the problem by any means. It just tells some complications. Any questions? Yes. Lots of rocks are limestone. About a third of all the rocks we have are limestones. Uh, Some people have tried to say that these limestones represent de novo rocks, rocks that are precipitated in place. And we know that limestones at least are transported and deposited. So they're very rapidly accumulated. But limestones can be transported from one place to another, and then they settle out, and then they're buried, and they're compacted together, and the lime recrystallizes sometimes, or just compacts together and makes a rock. But there are lots of limestones in the fossil record. Yes? Erratic boulders are boulders that are found somewhere they don't belong. Oftentimes, erratic boulders, you may find one out in the middle of a forest out here somewhere. Oftentimes, those are brought there by glaciers or by mud flows. Those are two possible explanations, both of which are catastrophic. And the glacier might pick it up and then float, and then when it melts, it drops it out. Those are called drop stones. And erratic boulders are also found in debris flows and catastrophic deposits that can transport boulders of infinite size. I wrote an article one time about this in Origins, and there are boulders up to 100 kilometers long that are deposited in various places in the world. There is one layer in Italy 100 kilometers long that's upside down. Try to figure that one out. Apparently the toe, when it was sliding, and apparently the toe caught on something and it just turned over all the way along. I mean, that kind of process is something we can't imagine happening in the world today. It's catastrophic on a scale that's hard to believe. So a 1 meter boulder, we think that's a really big boulder. When you talk about a 1 kilometer boulder, you're getting gigantic. But 100 kilometers, it's beyond imagination how you move something like that. But it's done, and it happens in these debris flow kinds of deposits in deep water. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Yes. Go ahead. How long do I think it took for Grand Canyon to erode? The best example we have for that is the Channel Scablands up in Washington State, which were for many years thought to have been formed over long periods of time. And then one guy by the name of Harlan Bretz figured out that this whole thing had to happen catastrophically. And he was ostracized from the geologic community for quite a number of years. Finally, he kept persisting, and eventually it caught on, and everybody accepted that it was a catastrophe with a wavelength of 100 feet and so on, all in one day. That kind of catastrophe could cut the Grand Canyon in no time at all. Whether that's the way it got cut or not, I don't know. But that's a possibility. Yes. If the sediments are unconsolidated and you have water, you can cut things really fast. If the sediments are rock, it's going to change the picture. And usually what happens with rock is it gets undercut. If it's hard rock, it may get undercut because there's softer rocks underneath, and then it falls off giant pieces. And that can also cut pretty fast. If it's hard all the way down, if it's turtles all the way down, it doesn't cut very fast. You can still do it, though. There are dams. What was it? Grand Coulee Dam, or whatever it's called, Boulder Dam, Hoover Dam, during the spillway, when they were trying to get rid of a lot of water in a hurry because there was too much water, it cavitated out the spillway, which is giant, which was all concrete with reinforced rebar in it, with big inch or two-inch thick rebar. It cut that stuff down and made a big hole in the spillway. Just running water, but running really fast. So powerful forces are generated by moving water. And it's hard for us to imagine because we don't ever see it. When we see a little bit of it, like that example, we see what's it's capable of. But we don't understand what would happen with that on a grand scale. And obviously, and this is another study Dr. Brandon and I are working on, if you look at the Grand Staircase in southern Utah, where you have all these layers that jump down like this, just like a staircase, those layers were not eroded by rainfall over thousands and thousands of years. Something came through there, swept through there, and cut all these layers off and took all that sediment out into the Pacific Ocean. But we have to try to figure out some of the logistics of that yet. Yes. What do I think of the canopy theory, the idea that there was a water canopy above the earth that was exhausted at the time of the flood? A friend of mine who's a geophysicist worked on that for several years, tried to figure out if there was any physical way of explaining how you could hold water up there. As the Bible seems to indicate, there was water above the firmament as well as below the firmament. And he finally gave up. And he just said, we don't understand it. We can't figure it out. So he's a lot smarter than I am. So I just have to stop and say, I don't understand that. We may have to figure that one out later. So I can't give you any insight on that. I think there was a lot of water up there somewhere because the Bible indicates that. I don't think there were fish swimming around up there, though. Okay, thank you very much. It's been a joy to be here.